the world economic conditions have changed dramatically. One of the largest changes, as she mentioned, was the rise in global inflation, with rising oil and food prices dominating headlines across the world. With inflation expected to continue, investors are increasingly faced with the problem of how to protect their portfolio in the new inflationary environment and ensure positive real returns. Inflation has not been this much of a problem for over two decades, and it's imperative as investment professionals that we address this problem. Today, we will present a research paper examining the relationship between inflation and commercial property returns. Historically, this relationship has been studied with direct property. However, as investors increasingly demand liquidity in their investments, we will compare both direct property and listed property in the relationship with inflation. And the paper will also address the two key components of the total return, namely income and capital growth to inflation as well. It is now my pleasure to introduce Steve Burton. Steve is the Managing Director and Global Portfolio Strategy Manager for ING Clarion Real Estate Securities, and comes to us today directly from Philadelphia. ING Clarion is one of the world's largest global property managers, with offices in the United States, Europe, and Asia. He manages in excess of $18 billion, and ING Clarion is the real estate equity management arm of ING Real Estate, which in turn manages in excess of $180 billion. Please welcome Steve.
Hello, good morning, almost afternoon. Well, I don't want to give you the punchline first, but I'll tell you, REITs global listed stocks are not the holy grail solution for inflation, but there are some benefits on the hedging front. But before getting into that specific topic, let me set the context for global listed property stocks here in Australia. They're called LPTs, now officially Australian REITs. Globally, they're called REITs, or they're just good old-fashioned real estate companies that get taxed, and they don't necessarily have to have the REIT structure, but generally specialize in commercial property. Hopefully this thing doesn't buzz on me too much. So let me provide some context and backdrop for global listed property stocks. And many of you are probably familiar with this, so I won't take too long. But clearly, by considering a global investment strategy, that's better than just regional. You get more diversification. That's intuitive, and I'll show you some numbers that back that up. We've got this structural catalyst of the REIT structure expanding globally, while REITs go back. Oh, good. That's maybe it's this guy. The villain, the BlackBerry. The REIT structure goes back to about 1971 here in Australia, back to 1960 in the U.S., back to early 70s in the Benelux countries, and more recently has been adopted elsewhere. And so that's sort of a structural low-grade catalyst that's going on. The REITs are all about dividend yield. They're all about income. This is an asset class that appeals to investors who want a high component of current return as part of total return. As many of the real estate stocks have corrected over the past year, we find that yield support sooner or later becomes a cushion, which doesn't necessarily exist in competing asset classes. Diversification, I'll show you some correlation numbers. If you look at returns going back, even though these stocks have been getting hammered as of late, the average per annum annualized returns over the long haul are competitive with equities and bonds. They're not bad. Over the long haul, these stocks do what they're supposed to do. And of course, I'll show you the academic structure of the efficient frontier, where the inclusion of listed property stocks in an otherwise diversified portfolio do what they're supposed to do, and that's to move the efficient frontier up and to the left. So with that, maybe a summary architecture of some of the points I'm about to cover, let's take a step back even further and answer the question of all the world's institutional quality commercial real estate, How much is listed? The answer is lower right-hand corner, a little over 10%. So we've got this massive universe of investable commercial property out there, of which about 10% is listed. The penetration by market is seen in the same column as the 10.1%, and shows that listed companies are more common in Hong Kong/China and here in Australia. When you read Hong Kong/China, think Hong Kong, don't think China. And in Australia, certainly if we took the A-class real estate, the good stuff, the percentage that's listed is probably more like 60%. So Australia has been a market leader with respect to securitizing property in the commercial sector. Underrepresented are continental Europe and Japan. They've got huge stores of property, which are only beginning to migrate from being privately and directly owned into the listed market. The J-REITs alone, the J-REITs began life in 2001. In fact, the two initial J-REITs went public September 10th, 2001. They now aggregate about 43 companies with about 35 to 40 billion U.S. equity market cap, which is bigger than what the entire U.S. REIT market was in the early 90s. So very quietly, the J-REITs are becoming a force. What does our universe look like? This shows 04 versus now. It's been growing in terms of number of companies. We're up to about 818, almost $1.5 trillion Aussie equity market value. It's not all about the U.S. The U.S. is less than a third. Asia Pacific has the largest representation, with solid representation in Europe, both the continent and UK, as well as the Americas is dominated by the U.S., but importantly, including Canada, and increasing opportunities in South America, such as Brazil. So it's big, it's diverse, it's liquid. This is not a boutique, small cap, micro cap sector. It's increasingly mainstream. At average daily trading volumes are about 9 billion US. That's a lot. We've put 200 to 300 million US to work in under a day or two. I won't say many times, but at least a handful of times. Liquidity is generally not a problem. There's always a counter example. Sure, you can find the company that's not as liquid, but on average, they are very liquid. REITs, countries with REITs, as mentioned, some of the old-timers, again, Australia, U.S., Benelux countries, importantly, France in 03, all the existing, not all, but most of the existing and certainly all the important listed French property companies in 03 began the conversion to the REIT structure as soon as the REIT structure was introduced in Japan. The U.K., beginning January 2nd, 07, so about a year and a half ago, same thing. All the existing, certainly the majors and the important companies converted to a REIT structure as soon as they could, as soon as it was legislated. Japan and Singapore are more like 5-6 years ago. Plus, they're important markets. Many of the business models out of Singapore, in particular, are going pan-Asian. Becoming a REIT isn't some benevolent thing that these companies do to make it sound good. A REIT structure is all about taxes. These companies are companies with management teams that want to save money and maximize cash flow if they can. Converting to a REIT structure is all about not having to pay corporate taxes, provided you play by the rules. You can only have so much gearing. That's usually an explicit or implicit rule. You've got to pay out 90%, in some cases 100% of your taxable net income as a dividend to the shareholders. You kind of got to play by the rules. You can only have so much development. But provided you do all that, then you don't have to pay taxes at the corporate level. It flows through to the shareholders. So these are greedy companies that want to maximize profits. It's not some benevolent gesture to convert to a REIT structure. It just tends to be tax efficient and therefore something that most management teams want to accomplish unless they have business structures that just don't make sense. If you're a pure developer, that's bad income, doesn't apply. You've got to be primarily a landlord, coupon clipper, maybe some redevelopment on the side, 5 to 10% of your total assets, but not half. So by definition, these tend to be companies that are almost forced to be more conservative, a little more boring. It's the tortoise, it's not the hare. We happen to be in an environment where you want to invest in the tortoise and not the hare. The hare is being punished in a big way. Other countries considering REIT legislation, You know, I would point out too, without talking too much on this topic, is since REITs are all about tax structure, country by country, they differ. You got to look at the details. They're not identical, but they tend to have structures that rhyme. They have a lot of commonalities. Dividend yields. I won't say it's all about yield, but yield's important. Global average now, far right's 4.7%. Companies with REIT structures tend to have the higher dividend yields, and that's part of the deal, paying out most, if not all, of your taxable net income as a dividend to the shareholder in exchange for not paying taxes at the corporate level. Some of the lower dividend yields are countries that either don't have the REIT structure or don't have much of it yet. And the Australia yield's getting better by the day, right? So even after all the dividend cuts and rebasing that's going on, the pro forma dividend yield looking forward should be well into the high single digits. So not bad. Not bad, provided the yield is covered and it's not a false yield. If we're to look at the diversification, more in coverage too. Coverage of the dividend yield, Australia is not emblematic of what's going on globally. On average, globally, coverage of dividends is about 1.6. So cash flow available to pay the dividends is about 1.6 times what the dividend actually is. The LPTs had gotten in the habit of paying out substantially all of their available cash flows, the dividends. So as soon as some little bump in the road comes along, the dividend becomes at risk. So what we've seen during earnings season and over the past 2 to 3 months is many companies rebasing their dividend policy to build in a little buffer, which is common outside of Australia. Diversification argument. We've run correlations of monthly total returns against other competing asset classes, including bonds and equities, MSCI World Equity Index. All these numbers are fairly low to moderate, if you wanted to quibble. The surprise to me always when I look at it is how low the correlation is to bonds. Investors want to think that the property stocks are bond-like, but the correlation numbers to bonds are actually fairly low over time. Now, a cynic might push back on this and go, okay, yeah, that's 10 years. What if you did it for the past 3 years? If you did it for the past 3 years, numbers are higher. I will grant you that. But over the long haul, you sort of get from a portfolio construction standpoint where you're supposed to get some patience required. Another important layer of diversification. We look at monthly total returns, local currency of just the property stocks themselves. Again, just the listed companies. That's what we do. We create portfolios of listed companies. These has nothing to do with direct real estate. We can buy and sell the stocks every day. And when that correlation is done region to region, the numbers are all fairly low. With one or two exceptions, we get up to 0.7 with France and Netherlands. And the correlation to the Hong Kong listed property stocks and the Singapore listed property stocks tends to be above average. Maybe it was so high that we actually yanked it from the chart, but that's about the most correlated that you can find. So this statistically tells us what is intuitive, and that is that real estate tends to be a local business. Most properties live and die off demand and supply within a radius of a couple miles, depending on the property type. If you're a shopping center, your trading market is what? Radius of 3 miles, maybe, depending on the type of center. Maybe if it's Bondi Junction, it's greater than that. But it's not thousands of miles. It's a local business, and it's a business that responds to demand locally. So it's not surprising that these numbers come out as low as they are. This statistically backs up what we kind of already suspect. This chart's not as complicated as it looks. It simply just provides total returns by country going back, and it highlights the best performer in that given year. So, again, common sense. In a given year, the winners move around on you. And so, as a result of that, we believe that a portfolio manager, an investment manager, must have the ability to look forward and attempt to overweight the prospective outperformers and underweight the underperformers. And with the full knowledge that we don't have the crystal ball and it's difficult to get right, we can show from an attribution standpoint that over time we have added value by overweighting the outperformers and underweighting the underperformers. Not perfect, but some value add. Interestingly, as an aside, until this year, okay, Australia's only won the Derby once, right? But if you did an annualized per annum going back, on a risk-adjusted basis, the LPTs were actually the best of the bunch, you know, until this year. So they've been very steady outperformers given the level of risk up until the recent re-rating. Performance, you know, we got good news and bad news. Bad news is trailing 1 year is pretty ugly in terms of absolute return. Interestingly, not too much worse than the MSCI World Equity Index, so it's not as if the property stocks are alone and underperforming, but certainly it's been a lot worse than what's gone on over the past 6 to 7 years over the long haul. 15 years, the property stocks do show that they can deliver returns which are competitive with equities and bonds. If you think about it, all real estate should be over the long haul, and the long haul is probably 20 to 40 years plus, is leveraged inflation with value add from management teams that are good at recycling capital. So the types of real estate returns that should be provided over the long haul, unleveraged, are probably in the 4 to 6% range. You know, with leverage, you can get up to high single digits. That's all it is. It's the tortoise. It's not tech. And so we see that over the course of various cycles, and we're in a down cycle right now, that the stocks do deliver returns which, you know, fit with the logic of what real estate is over time. Values, not to jump right into a chart which is has a lot of information in it, but one thing we do at ING Clarion Real Estate Securities is to attempt to answer the question, all right, where do the stocks trade? Are they at a discount or premium to what the underlying real estate's actually worth? And what we call that notion of what the real estate's actually worth is net asset value, or NAV. And NAV is not, it's not a number given by the company. It's not a third-party number. It's our number of looking at the cash flows of the underlying real estate, putting a cap rate under it. I mean, a cap rate that's a real cap rate, not a look back, but a look forward. Doing a DCF off the development business, if there is a development business. Throwing a multiple on the services business. If they got service fee income, you know, we'll throw a 5 to 7 multiple on that. And then coming up with the sum of the parts value of what we think the real estate's actually worth. Then we compare that to what's implied in the market. And what we see globally is that the listed property companies generally are trading at discounts to that notion of what the underlying real estate's actually worth. In fact, on average, that discount is about 17%. And in Australia, is at 20% discount. Now this compares to a long-term premium in Australia in the 5 to 10% range. So the LPTs have fallen out of bed big time. But arguably, a number of the other geographies are also looking cheap. Another way to look at this is to look, to the extent you can read it, these two rows at the bottom have cap rates that we are using when we calculate our estimate of the NAVs. And when I say our, I refer to our analytical teams in Hong Kong, London, Tokyo, and the U.S. And then we look at the implied cap rate, which really is just solving for the cap rate after you take into account where the prices of the stocks are now. And the reason the implied cap rate is important is that if you're, you know, assume you're a chief investment officer of a pension fund, all you really want to know is, okay, what are the total return prospects over the next, say, 5 to 10 years for stocks, bonds, some, you know, other asset classes, including the real estate stocks. And when the real estate stocks are looked at, we see implied cap rates. If you went out and just bought a basket of global, if you bought the benchmark right now for global listed stocks, you'd be buying an in-place yield of 6.3%. Now, I'm about to tell you via different chart or otherwise that we believe that earnings growth going forward is in the 5 to 6% range as we look forward. So there's growth. But say you're that CIO and you're going, you know, I'm not going to believe that guy, Steve Burton. It's not 5 to 6. I'm going to assume it's 2 to 3. Well, if you add that growth on top of the in-place yield of 6.3, you get the high single-digit prospective total returns. If you're willing to assume that the stocks maybe have been oversold and there could be a touch of multiple expansion, you can get yourself up to low double digits without too much work. Said more simply, the implied yields, given where the stocks are trading now, are starting to look interesting. The UK, I call the epicenter of negativity. I don't know if it's a nation of curmudgeons or if it rains too much or the food's too bad, but that market, the analysts just want it to be bad. They want it to be worse than it is. It's not that bad. And the stocks have sold off big time. The irony or the challenge of all this is the listed sector has voted with its feet, sold off, and reflected a lot of bad news looking forward, bad news which may or may not happen. You know, if we get into a downside macroeconomic scenario looking forward, then the current valuations are probably about right. But looking forward, we just don't see, you know, world economic growth falling apart. In a more expected case scenario, the stocks have overdone it. Now we got to sit there and wait for all the negative headlines to come out for direct real estate, which is appraisal-based, and is going to be marked down over the next year, if not 2 years, whereas the listed market's already there. So it's that dilemma of knowing it's kind of like cheap with no catalyst. It's a buy, but you got to be patient. It's a buy, but you got to weather the storm as you pick up the newspaper in 2 weeks about some direct wholesale fund that's, you know, being marked down because it's appraisal-based and therefore lagged. So we find, you know, maybe that's a long-winded way of saying the valuations are starting to get interesting, even given the decelerating economic growth, which clearly is affecting everything. Yeah, we split it into two because Japan, you know, but we didn't do that for Singapore. If you look at Japan and the global benchmark, Japan right now has about 13%. Maybe about 9 of that, 9/13 is the legacy big development companies, a Mitsubishi Estate, a Mitsui Fudosan. These companies have been around forever. They're great companies. They're dominant. The J-REITs are about 4/13 of that. So they're big enough to give some attention, and the valuations tend to be fairly disparate, you know, given how different their business models are. J-REITs very sleepy, coupon clipping. The developer's a lot more active. Like the academic case of the efficient frontier shows that in an otherwise diversified portfolio, stocks, bonds, you know, with bonds both long-term, short-term, once real estate's added at 15%, that's arbitrary. This isn't optimized. In fact, if we're optimized, real estate would be like 80%. But with a little bit of real estate in an otherwise diversified portfolio, the efficient frontier does what it's supposed to do, which is move up and to the left. Or said differently, an investor achieves more return given a constant level of risk. So the academic framework appears to be in place for the inclusion of a global listed property stock strategy. You know, you of course will be more interested in, yeah, but what about now? But topically, one topic in preparation for this conference that we were asked to come up with a topic that's relevant now, and inflation is big time relevant now. And so we being the head of research and myself, decided to take on a topic which many other academics have taken on over time, and that is, how does real estate respond to inflation? Is it a hedge or not a hedge? And we found that a lot of the research has been done on the direct side, and the results come back and they're mixed. What we found is that not much research has been done on the listed side. You know, the listed stocks, in effect, certainly in a U.S. context, even though since they've been around since 1960, they're still relatively new. It hasn't been mainstream until the past 5 to 10 years. So we decided to take a look at that and ran a number of regression analyses and I'd like to touch upon some of our conclusions. I'll tell you now, we don't have the perfect answer, but came up with some results that I thought were moderately rewarding, if not completely. First, let's look at the facts. Inflation, we all know that inflation forecasts are up. This simply looks at forecasts in June 08 versus 6 months prior. Where blue is the June 08, so up in all kinds of places, especially emerging markets, especially China. You know, but even in developed markets, we got a little inflation scare going on. It's not really new news to anyone who's bought gas or food as of late. So we decided to take a look at the relationship between CPI and U.S. REIT returns, both the income component and total return component. And the reason we stuck with the U.S. is to keep it focused, because the moment you open Pandora's box of going with all the geography, suddenly you've got about a 10-dimensional research project underway that probably takes months and not weeks. So to keep it focused, we focused on the U.S. REITs. We went back to 94 because that really represents what I would call the beginning of the modern REIT era from a, you know, from a size standpoint. I mean, we weren't even, you know, $50 billion equity market cap back in 94. Going back to the 70s, the total aggregate market cap was like $2 billion or less. It was almost nothing. So at the risk of having too short a time frame, we had to pick one that was relevant. So 04 to 07, we looked at U.S. REIT total returns using the Nareit Equity Index. That's the standard REIT index in the U.S. And we looked at, separately, net operating income, the income component of total return. The U.S. REIT market continues to be the world's largest. It's about 40% of the pie, although it's diminishing somewhat, in part the result of a lot of M&A over the past 3 years. It used to be, you know, over half. So that's the data set. We said, all right, let's keep this focus. Let's look at REIT returns over this time period. Now, putting the academic stuff to the side, let's again put some common sense on this. To me, knowing what I know, and I used to work in direct real estate, despite being enlisted now, I know that many lease structures out there are designed to pass through inflation, especially in the retail sector. There are a lot of CPI escalations. There are a lot of ways that landlords have devised over the years to be able to capture any upward pressure on costs, including any increased costs as the result of inflation. Common sense tells you that if you're in a shorter lease length property type, hotels being the extreme example with an average lease length of, I think, slightly less than two nights, the mark-to-market there is extremely fast. Apartments. Apartment rates are a big sector in the U.S. Your average apartment lease is a year long. If you happen to own the apartment complex, guess what? You can mark-to-market, worst case, once every year. Other lease types have longer duration. Office and retail, industrial tend to be more in the, you know, 4 to 8 year range, unless you're an anchor tenant. You know, an anchor tenant in the mall might be 20 years plus. In the UK, we've got some longer lease lengths with an interesting mechanism called the upward only review. Every 5 years, the rent can only go up and not down. It's a brilliant invention. I'm just waiting for it to go away, but it lives. So common sense tells you that there are ways for an owner of real estate to capture any kind of increase in costs, including, of course, any of those caused by inflation. So given that knowledge going in, we thought, well, we expect to find some positive relationship when we run the regressions of CPI against the income component of total return. And indeed, when we did this, we came up, you know, R squared is, you know, of all the numbers and statistics land, and you know, I'll acknowledge that I'm not your regression guru, but certainly Indy Carlikar has got a PhD and is the head of our research and strategy, is R squared's the one statistic that's in, that's critical, because the higher the R squared, the more explanatory the relationship is. So as we did the regression of just the income component of total return over this time period, we came up with an R squared. These are all very high numbers. An R squared of 0.71. The highest you can get is 1. 0.71 altogether. very high in the retail sector. It's not surprising, again, given the CPI escalations that, that shopping centers and malls generally have in place. Apartments may be a little lower than I would have thought, given, you know, given that one-year lease term. But these are, you know, these are all pretty solid numbers when it comes to regression statistics, and they suggest in a convincing way that indeed there is correlation, there is a relationship between inflation as represented by CPI and income returns of the listed property companies. Now, granted, income is just income, and the income we used was an unleveraged income notion, so no interest expense. And we think that's a cleaner number because what you really want to get at, you want to get out the noise of maybe too much leverage or not enough leverage and just get at the pure income, revenues less expenses, unleveraged that these companies are producing by property type. Now, if we look at the NOI produced by the various property types, again, these are U.S. listed companies back to 94 because we believe that's a relevant time period. I'm not trying to data mine here. It's just that the U.S. REIT market was tiny before then and not nearly as diversified or grown up, not nearly as specialized by property type. This may be a little bit difficult. CPI is the orange one. Look at malls. Malls is yellow. The NOI of malls is like hovering just above CPI the whole time. Malls are kind of the star student here of having stable NOI. The only two that kind of fell out of bed a little bit in the dot-com bust are apartments and to a lesser extent office and industrial. But we see the retail sectors, malls and shopping centers, holding up fairly well. Separately, and this chart does not show this, if we're to look at the early to mid-90s, I mean, this captures the mid-90s, but not the early 90s, in U.S. real estate, NOI of the regional malls held up the best by a long shot of all the major property types. And that's not intuitive because people think consumer spending is coming down, the mall's not going to do well, but it's just not true. The mall business is a powerful franchise. You know, I shouldn't use this word, but I think of it as being oligopolistic. If you've got a mall in a trade area, guess what? You're the only mall. No one's going to build a new mall next to you. In fact, the locals aren't going to let the permitting go through. And anyone who owns malls, which include a number of very smart management teams, including Westfield, know that if you have a mall and you've got that franchise, as long as you're not stupid and you keep it up to snuff and spend money to make it better, that's a great long-term business. The percentage rent in a mall tends to be only about 3% of the top line. So if consumer spending turns down, that 3% disappears, but that's not much. You know, other than that, you're going to get your income. Tenants are going to pay the rent unless they go bankrupt, and that rent tends to go up over time, not down. So the mall business is a very powerful business, and that shows up in some of the numbers here. Okay, then we said, all right, that's listed. Let's look at direct. So we looked at the income component of direct real estate, and direct's a different animal because here the main index tends to be appraisal-based, so therefore has a lot of baggage about the lags and the construct of being appraisal-based. But nonetheless, income component, R-squared, 0.32. These numbers aren't as strong as the listed, but they still indicate a fairly, strong's not the right word, but these... You know, there's something going on here. These are high enough to indicate that, yes, there is a relationship between CPI and the income component of direct real estate, with, again, malls showing up well. All right, the bad news in all this is when we run the regression against the total return, both listed and direct, the relationship isn't that strong. So here we've got this great thing going on where the income component of listed is a star, reflects inflation. Landlords are going to get the money, just a matter of timing, depending on property type and lease structure. But when you run it against total returns, the numbers aren't nearly as strong. And all this tells, and this, in a way, it's not too surprising. I mean, taking on the inflation topic is, it's a bear. This is not a friendly topic to take on. And the results looking back, which are mostly direct, have been mixed. And I think all that tells us is there's a lot going on There are a lot of other factors at work when you look at total returns that go way beyond what inflation's doing. So we go, you know, we go from stellar results on income to somewhat disappointing results for total return. So we don't have the holy grail in terms of an inflation hedge, but we do have an asset class which over time captures that, and over time has average annualized per annum returns, you know, past 15, 20 years, you know, that are high single digits plus. So over time we know they do what they're supposed to do, and they ultimately capture increased costs as they are passed on to the tenants. Hey, maybe I'll go to the next slide and see what your questions are going to be. This just says, we're ING Real Estate, we're big, we won some awards. I'm kind of skeptical when it comes to awards. We can move money around. You know, from year end, 6 months ago, we were overweight Asia Pacific, we've gotten underweight, mostly because a lot of the Asian companies are development-based. That's not what you want now. You want boring, coupon clipper, steady Eddie. As such, we've allocated some of that money back to the U.S. This typically would have been a year that the LPTs would have outperformed, but the business models have strayed over the past 5 to 7 years, and the companies are kind of re-rating to reflect that. That's not to suggest that the LPTs do not have some outstanding companies in their universe. 62% Americas, that's mostly U.S., some Canada. Canada is a cheaper version of the U.S. as I think of it. Performance, you know, of our fund, which is ex-Australia, these numbers, even though they're negative, are a lot less negative than a global average that includes the developers and which includes Australia. All right, and everyone's got to pick.
No, not yet.
Number five.
All right, look, that's good. I let Steve run a little bit over time because I think it's a topic that a lot of us want to hear about. Chris Schroeder, is Chris in the room?
Peter Green.
Oh, sorry, Peter.
Yeah.
Do you want to sort of lead us away with a couple of questions?
Sure. Just a bit of background. I'm Peter Green from Lonsec, which is a research house here in Australia. Just as a question, I was having a look at specifically malls and retail property in a high inflation environment. And I could see your point about income and there being a hedge of inflation. I guess in an environment of high petrol prices, the unknown is consumer spending and consumer confidence. Just wondering what your views are on total returns in a period of high petrol prices and lower consumer confidence.
Yeah, high petrol prices are affecting everybody. There's going to be less consumer spending. On malls, I think what disappears is that percentage rent, which on average, again, is a number that's about 3%. On average, you know, call less than 5 to play it safe. So that percentage rent disappears to the extent, you know, sales trail off. But otherwise, the mall landlord's collecting the rent as long as the tenant doesn't go bankrupt. It's contractual. And one surprise is that the better malls, and a better mall would say more than $450, say $500 U.S. in sales per square foot, at the better malls, there's generally a waiting list of 2, 3, 4 tenants that want to take that spot should someone go bankrupt. So the key is sticking with quality. And consumer spending, too, on a per capita basis, it can trail off. But if you've got demographic growth that's positive, in aggregate, it's still going up. So provided the supply base is fairly fixed, all you need is moderate demographic growth. And, you know, voila, the downturn in consumer spending turns out to be a kind of a second derivative phenomenon instead of first derivative. And the retail venues, certainly the stronger ones, do better than one would think. It's counterintuitive. I mean, I'm with you. But, I know in the U.S. people just shop. They just spend all their money. I don't, but they do.
has there been a recent increase in vacancies, or is it a bit early to tell?
It's a little bit early. You know, there's been a little tick up in vacancies. By property type, nothing alarming. The surprise is, even though the stocks have sold off a lot, the bottoms-up fundamentals, as we analyze the companies after earnings season, they're not bad. I mean, Simon Property Group, and I'm sure Westfield's the same, is rolling up rents, you know, rents that are expiring, and they got to re-sign. they're rolling up to market by 15 to 20%. Midtown Manhattan office, you know, which has gotten crushed, those rents are rolling up 30 to 35%. So we got this funny phenomenon where the in-place fundamentals are decent. The cynics are saying, yeah, but wait a year, wait 2 years. And maybe the cynics are right, but if they're right, a lot of bad stuff's got to happen between now and then, and bad stuff that's totally speculative and not based on what we can see right now. Germany's been disappointing. It's got two REITs. It's got huge potential. Patience required. And I think the reason is the banks sell the open-end funds, and it's a high-fee product, so why get rid of it? So they're not real incentivized to go convert a lot of those to the REIT structure. And it won't happen until the companies start to trade at premiums to NAV, because why go public if day one it's just going to roll down 10 to 15%? So we need to get back into premiums, and we need the German banks to start to get religion on what the structure can do, but it's going to take a while.
One more question. Sorry, I know we're sticking past time enough. Good seeing you.
Just looking at the tax deferral component, when you look at the after tax return on Aussie, particularly the unlisted trust, the tax deferred component is extremely low, which ranks up the yield a little bit. On the global property securities fund, what sort of tax deferral is applicable across the country? Is it sort of a general number? I'm not sure.
I don't know. Yeah, I know with the U.S. REITs, there's a tax deferral built in. I couldn't tell you the average number, but I doubt it's more than 20% or so. Of the yield in a given year. It's not the driver. That's sort of like a icing on the cake reason for looking at the sector, but it's not the driver of incremental flows. I know that.
They're pretty tight on time here. In fact, there's the master at the back. Just give me a signal.
8 minutes.
8 minutes. All right. Well, what we're going to do, we'll take one more question, and then I'll get Alistair to come and just say a few words about ING, because Steve wouldn't have been here without them. And then, of course, we do the all-important voting. So,
Based on your comment on retail, why, then, is Centro reducing the value of their U.S. shopping malls? And do you have any comments on them generally?
I've been asked the question, is what's happening in Australia kind of an early warning signal for the rest of the world? And the answer is no. All that's going on in Australia, what's being penalized now are companies that didn't take their corporate finance course in university. And had they done that, they would have learned within the first couple of months, you try to match assets and liabilities. And you don't get so extended so that you've got maturities. You don't want to get caught with a huge refinancing because the capital markets are a fickle beast, and every once in a while they freeze up, and companies which haven't matched and which haven't staggered maturities and don't have like 80% fixed, 20% floating, get taken out to the woodshed. Almost, I won't say unfairly so, but way beyond belief. And Central got caught. It's not the first company to get caught. It's probably about the 1,000th. I've seen it before. You know, the U.S. Hotel REIT in 1998, same thing. Got caught with a bridge loan to buy some time until permanent financing could be fixed. And it's a rookie mistake. You don't do that. So any companies that cranked up gearing and got caught, you know, with a need to refinance a lot of debt and equity during the exact time when the capital markets froze up, and granted, none of us can predict when that's going to happen. All you know is it's going to happen. And it tends to happen once every 7 years or so. You know, just hearkening back to the Russian debt crisis, long-term capital, and all that. So what's going on is it's like the jungle. You know, the predators see something that they can buy cheap, maybe. So the bid-ask is like this. Sellers want that, and the buyers are like, no, we want this. And so they're going to try to bottom fish off that. And the only thing that'll cause the prices to go up is if it gets competitive. You know, some private equity steps in and so on. And, you know, the quality of the U.S. shopping center portfolio for Centro, too, is average at best. It's not prime stuff. There's some junk in there, some good stuff in there, but it's not some trophy portfolio that a lot of potential buyers are going to scramble to bid up.
That's all we've got time for. I'll hand it over to the master to say a few summary words, and then we're into the voting stage.
Okay, thank you very much, Steve. If you all put your hands together for Steve Burton. Thank you very much, Steve. Steve, we greatly appreciate the insights you gave us into the global property market and obviously its link with inflation in these very important times as well. In closing, ladies and gentlemen, I'd just like to give you a brief overview and highlight the strengths and capability of ING Global Property Securities Fund. The ING Global Property Securities Fund is one of the highest rated global property securities funds in the market by research houses. It's got the highest rating from Lonsec, highly recommended. It also has the highest rating from Standard & Poor's, 5 stars, and it's recommended by Morningstar. As a result, it's not surprising that the fund is also one of the most awarded funds in the marketplace as well. It's got most notably 2007 Listed Property Fund of the Year from Standard & Poor's, and we're also in the running for 2008. We're in the final as well, and we're quietly confident of hopefully repeating the same result. In summary, the three distinguishing features that make the ING Global Property Securities Fund so awarded and so highly rated by the research house community in Australia are, firstly, ING Clarion's access to direct property research around the globe. ING Real Estate is one of the largest real estate companies in the world, and ING Clarion has direct filter into all that real estate around the world and all that real estate research, and it's a resource that's well acknowledged by research houses. Secondly, it's got multiple sources of alpha, bottom-up stock picking, regional allocation, as Steve went through. They get the asset allocation right, they get the regional allocation right on a regular basis, and it's a proven source of value add. And thirdly, the fund has one of the largest and most experienced investment teams in the market. And as we know, in investments, it's all about consistency. The large team, consistent process delivers results. So thank you very much for coming to the ING Global Property Session. Very much appreciate your attendance, and I hope you enjoy the rest of the Portfolio Construction Forum. Thank you.